Talk given Saturday, 8th August, 1981. I thought we might consider together, why do people turn to religion? Unless, of course, they are born with a natural bias or a strong leaning towards religion, something which is inexplicable. That is to say, this natural bias. And also consider how and why one should be interested and concerned with living the religious life. We all know how all the world suffers a great deal in some way or other. And everyone tries to alleviate or assuage that suffering and that pain by worldly methods. There is the drive towards pleasure, towards which people unfortunately interpret as happiness, not realizing that happiness, true happiness, is denied us if we bend our life energies towards the deliberate pursuit of pleasure. So people try to compensate for their suffering by means of pleasure. Then again, there are those who turn to religion because people turn to religion, therefore, when they find that chasing pleasure does not bring about true peace or happiness or well-being, but usually the very opposite. Then again, there are those who are anxious. They are concerned about what happens to them after death. There is the basic assumption that something which is called oneself persists as an entity and an identifiable entity after the death of the body. And the religions of the world, the ordinary teachings throughout the world, have always presented the idea either of coming back to this world in terms of rebirth, or the idea that if one has led a good life, one will go to the happy place forever and ever, or if one has led a bad life, to the unhappy place forever and ever. And man has expended no little energy and ingenuity in inventing the most marvelous tortures and sufferings in hell. It's almost amusing to read in detail what has been invented. I think Buddhism and Christianity are two of the religions which have been most prolific with the most terrible inventions. One has to read some of the discourses and some of the statements in the texts to find this out. So people are concerned and they are afraid. So they turn, then they are told that if they live the religious life as good citizens, they will escape the torment of hell and perhaps enjoy the comfort of heaven always. Then again, people turn to religion from a purely worldly point of view. They gain something from it. They gain a certain degree of security here and now by participating in, being accepted as expounders of religious truth and so forth. In other words, they become priests and prelates and so forth, and they study religion as such. They try to live also according to the teachings of religion in so many cases throughout the world's history, not too successfully, but they try, perhaps. Must give them the benefit of the doubt. On the other hand, we do know as a historical fact that they have been some of the most powerful influences for harm and destruction and cruelty to mankind. And of course, what they have presented has been far from truth. It is all spun out of their imagination, their very picture of the Supreme God or Brahman or Atma or whatever word you like to use, is a projection out of their own imperfect minds, their own brains. Of course, that is rather natural, because even the animal thinks in terms of himself in apotheosis as the culmination of his development and perfection. I suppose the tortoise thinks of God as the grand tortoise, and the peacock as the one with the most marvelous feathers, and so forth and so forth. And the tiger as the most successful hunter and killer beast of prey that there ever was. And man projects his God in similar ways, right from the very beginning. The interesting point is, as far as man is concerned, that he does project himself in apotheosis, in the perfection, in terms of the perfection of that which he considers worthy and good. Of course, his conceptions are hopeless misconceptions all too often, but nevertheless, the trend is in that direction. It's a trend towards the perfect, towards the most worthy, in fact. So, by entering into the religious life, a person gains respect and honor and many benefits, and this is something which underlies the undertaking of the religious life professionally. Mixed with this, there is also the altruistic side in the person, which wants genuinely to do good in the world. What spoils the altruism is the fact that he is not capable of seeing to what extent egoism and vanity are tied up in this altruism. And also, time and again, the expectation of honors, of, in many cases, wealth, possessions, and so forth, associated with it all. Then there are some who live the religious life because they have what we may call spiritual ambitions. They know that by living the religious life, certain psychic powers can be released if they go through certain disciplines. And this naturally inflates the ego. And the person thinks that by the use of these powers, he can ward off in his own life the unpleasant. And where this element in man's nature has degraded him to a very great extent, he tends to use these powers to harm his enemies, to harm those who are not in tune with his particular beliefs and so on. This in past ages was known as black magic. There is a reality in this practice of black magic, or any sort of magic which is intended to destroy your enemy. And it has played an interesting part in promoting true religiousness also. If you consider how it is said that Abraham heard the call, the divine call, and he left Chaldea and went westwards towards Canaan. Now, Chaldea at this time had many, many sects, all giving different sorts of teachings, and each propounding to be the true religion. And the priests misused their knowledge to practice black magic. Abraham was well aware of this. And within his inner spirit, there came the urge to take the true teaching which he did possess. This was the original Kabbalah as such. He took that teaching with him westwards and preserved the teachings of the Kabbalah, which were the most highly developed and pure teachings existing in that region in those days. And there was another instance in the Gathas of Zarathustra. We find Zarathustra wailing unto God that there were so many false teachers around him, and they tormented his soul with what they taught. And he prays to Ahura Mazda to help him to establish the true teaching and the true religion. Now, Zarathustra did not move out of Iran. He stayed there. It's all in that region, Chaldea, Assyria, and so forth. He stayed there, and he succeeded, and thereby the Zarathustrian faith was founded, and it has had a very considerable influence upon the subsequent rising of Judaism, of Christianity, and of Islam, all of them. Also, Zarathustrianism spread westward into the Mediterranean region, and you all know about the worship of Mithras worship, which nearly took hold of Rome, but didn't quite succeed. Christianity instead flourished there ultimately. So those are two instances where the practice of black magic, with all their ghastly rituals and so on, produced a certain amount of good by reaction. Abraham going westward, taking the pure teaching with him, and Zarathustra giving out the teachings there in Iran as such. Do remember that the Zarathustrian Iranians, it's a mispronunciation to call them Iranians. It's Iran, and the people are Iranis, as they themselves call themselves, or if we use our term, they are Iranians. Zarathustra founded the religion there, and it has survived right into modern times. The Parsis of the world, they're a very small number now, just a little over, if that much, 120,000 people. The population of Lewisham, I think, exceeds 120,000. So that is the total population of Parsis who are by birth Zarathustrians. There are about, it is estimated there are about 20 or 30,000 still in Iran who don't have a really happy time there. They are somewhat better off since the late Shah's father came to the throne. He in fact invited the Parsis to come over in bulk and settle in Iran and help in the advancement of the whole country in so many ways, because the Parsis had proved what they could do in India. But of course that didn't happen. Then again, we have to look into other aspects of why people turn to religion and to the living of the religious life, because they find that in living the religious life there is an inner calm and peace, a poise and a harmony within oneself which emerges. And this makes life very, very different. They can face the troubles and the turmoils of ordinary worldly existence with confidence. So this is also another reason why people turn to religion. But now let us consider to what extent some of the deepest teachings of religion have affected mankind. We can't go into everything. We'll just take one or two points. Those who wish to live the religious life have in the past and even in our own times tended to go away from the worldly life, to dissociate themselves from the worldly life, go into monasteries and live as monks. The Buddha, for example, called all those who wished to live the holy life, called them away from the home life, to go out of home into homelessness, out of the family into the absence of family ties and activities and so forth. So from the familiar condition they went out into an unfamiliar condition. But what they obtained thereby was freedom from the ordinary social responsibilities and duties which are involved in living the family life and living the life of a citizen. And because they were devoted to their task, people in India certainly, and also in the early centuries in other parts of, in various parts of the world, gave them great respect and supplied the necessities of existence. So there was no problem of unemployment and earning one's living where they were concerned. And by living this religious life in seclusion, they did realize certain things which we may call the fulfillment of the purpose of human existence. They realized, just as we can realize, that the world as it is in a subhuman state. And in the religious life lived by them, three elements were emphasized rather strongly. The idea of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Not all of them understood these properly. Take, for instance, obedience. Obedience, right to this day in the world, means doing what you're told, what your superiors tell you, or those who employ you, and so forth. That is obedience, doing what you're told. Also, it is conforming to the pattern which society lays down for the everyday life, conforming to it. One must not challenge it. That is laid down as such. It is law, and it is, as in India, for instance, under the caste system, it is sacred law. And therefore, everybody had to live according to that law. So, this conforming was understood as obedience. But they didn't realize that the very word obedience, now I'm taking the English word, of course, and its derivation and meaning, but the same meaning holds good at all times and in all places for obedience. Derived from ob and audire, audire meaning to hear, to listen. Now this is very, very important. What does one listen to? If one wants to live the religious life, the life of purity, of calm, of insight, what does one listen to? One may also ask, what does one look at and how does one look at things? One listens to what we commonly call the inner voice. But the inner voice has to be a pure voice. The inner voice of many a monk, many a priest, is not exactly a pure voice. It is not pure because he has not attempted to live the simple virtues of being truthful, of being harmless, of being free of self-indulgence in any and every way. And therefore that inner voice can be a misleading voice. Also, it can be a misleading voice as regards the formulation of dogmas, doctrines, and so forth. There are many examples of this. And so obedience, in the real sense, is not fulfilled. Take chastity. Chastity for the world has always been associated with sexual morality. But is this the real, the full meaning of chastity? Of course, sexual morality is part of the story. But chastity means to live the clean life, the pure life again. And it also means to live the skillful life, the life in which everything that one does is beautified, made beautiful, chaste, as we call it. You see, it is also related to the word castus in Latin, which means pure, utterly pure. So that is chastity. And it has to be in thought, feeling, word, and action. Chastity is not a happy word today in the minds of a considerable portion of the population. Just as morality or virtue is considered by some as a dirty word. But those people never seem to question whether it is the word and what it means is dirty, or whether they themselves are dirty. That is an important point which is missed out in the considerations of millions of minds. However, so chastity goes by the board, therefore. But when it is there, it really makes life utterly beautiful, secure, inwardly secure, and a life which has the greatest good influence upon society, if only society was able to appreciate and see it and understand it. And then we may take poverty. Poverty is understood by all the world as the deprived state. It is perfectly true that when poverty is synonymous with deprivation, it is indeed an evil state, an ill state. And so strong is the drive in human beings for possession, for possessing power, for possessing property, objects, and innumerable other possessions. You see, so strong is that drive that they think and act in terms of getting rid of poverty as it exists in the world, in all parts of the world. But is that the real poverty? If one is the possessor of much wealth and uses it for his own self-gratification, or for nefarious purposes or ill purposes, that wealth is a curse. Curse to himself, curse to his society. But if he regards that wealth as a trustee to be used not only for his own security and the security of his family or friends, but also for the security of society as a whole. This is one element of the old caste system of India, which is almost entirely forgotten when scholars write their criticisms about this caste system. they are of the four main castes, the merchant caste, the one which was concerned with the making of wealth, was the Vaishya caste as such. And it was the sacred duty of the Vaishya caste to see that no one who lived in the village or town or district where his own home was in a state of deprivation. If he was really deprived, then the wealth of the Vaishya caste man was used to give him the necessities of existence and to see that he was free from such anxieties. Food, warmth, shelter, all these came into the story. So now, that sort of philanthropy was practiced in that caste system. And it was done not by the edict of law of a welfare state idea, but through the goodwill and willingness to be in line with what the caste system, rules of the caste system, laid down for members of that caste. Of course, as the centuries passed in India, things underwent a very, very great change for the worse in so many respects. But in some respects, the good things of the caste system have survived right up till today. It's a pity that those ideas do not find the same sort of free expression as they did in the past. Now let us look at why is the religious life of such importance? We know that this universe came into being through the activity of the primordial creative energy, which is associated with pure or absolute consciousness. And with the differentiation of energy and the proliferation of consciousness, grades of being came into existence to compose the entire universe. Not only the universe of the astronomer, the visible universe which we see in terms of galaxies and stars and so forth, but the universe in terms of grades of consciousness and its activity throughout all existence. Now, with the human kingdom as such, a remarkable difference is observed as compared with the other kingdoms of nature. We possess that in us which, when it arrives at its perfection, is pure mind. Now, mind is that form of creative energy which releases cosmos out of chaos. I have said this dozens of times, but perhaps it may bear repetition. It releases cosmos out of chaos. That is mind. Now, this particular form of creative energy, which is mind, interacting with matter, the body, gives rise to our own individual psyche. None of us has an individual separate mind. Not one of us, including the holy ones. We all, each and every one of us, has psyche. And by psyche I mean the manner in which our mental processes, as we call them, take place. Our thoughts, our feelings, our ideas, our conceptions, our beliefs, and the activity which is associated with all that. Particularly strong is the element of feeling. Feeling plays one of the most important parts in our whole psychical life. So now, psyche is partly spiritual in the sense that pure mind has played its part in releasing psyche in us. And it is partly physical, purely physical, the body as such. Psyche is rooted in the physical body. There is nothing that we think or feel or speak or do which is purely mental or purely physical. It is psychophysical, entirely. One can never dissociate psyche and the physical body as such. Now, if it is the psyche which needs purification, you know how the Buddha said, cease to do evil, strive to do good, purify the mind. Now, in the days of the Buddha, and even in modern times, people do not differentiate between psyche and mind in the real sense. I admit that this is entirely, I accept responsibility for making this arbitrary statement, that mind is that archetypal form of the primordial creative energy which, interacting with body, gives rise to psyche. And mind is the power that releases the whole cosmos. Now, the whole cosmos isn't conscious of how it came into being. I mean, the stars don't. You know, you can talk to Jupiter and Venus for the next 100 years and you won't get a squeak out of them as to how they came into being. They know nothing at all. It is we who have this extraordinary ability to know as such, which is due to the fact that the brain, which developed through hundreds of thousands of years, is a piece of apparatus which makes self-cognition possible, which makes possible the faculty of foreseeing, looking ahead, and taking advantage of what knowledge we may have of the past in order to help development in the real sense of the term. So you see, this psyche has what we call divinity as its potentiality. It is potential within us. Human beings, when they are fully human, are happy creators. They are blissful creators. And blissful creativeness is what people have ascribed to God as such. That is our potentiality. But whilst that is our potentiality, and it is in actual activity, in manifestation, only to a limited extent, the fact remains that because it is rooted in the physical body, in the animal body, remember, we also suffer the defects due to our animal heritage. And our animal heritage is that part of us which tends to make us remain confined to self-concerns all the time. Something for oneself. Food, security, warmth, pleasure, and all the rest of it. This is the animal part of it. We are not prepared, therefore, to free ourselves from this bondage to the animal part of us, which, when it functions freely in us, actually makes beasts of us, not good animals. Animals are good animals, but we alone can be beasts and horrible creatures. So that is where the conflict, the state of conflict comes in between this animal part and the divine potentiality in us. So now, living the religious life means that this potentiality of pure mind, which is the particular aspect of creative energy which releases harmony, order, fulfillment, and beauty, real beauty, all comes into being. The basis, of course, the fundamental basis is with living the pure life, the moral life, as we might call it. What you and I can do to help society, our society in this world today, is to restore the fine meaning of the word morality. Get rid of all these idiotic ideas of people who call the good things, the really good things, dirty, or old-fashioned, or fuddy-duddy, and so forth. They are the people who believe that sort of thing and live according to that sort of idea are the real destroyers of civilization and human living. So when this becomes clearer and clearer to us, and we see the truth of all this, and we live the good life in the real sense of the word, we lay the foundations for that type of attentiveness and paying concentrated attention to that which is the highest in us, so that we can realize communion, samadhi, to use the Indian word. Samadhi is not just concentration. The power of concentration is necessary, but samadhi means the supreme unity, the one, the state in which the oneness of the unity of the universe is fully realized in our own beings through our own psychophysical organism as such. And this coming to fruition of the mind is one of the supreme purposes of our existence as such. When that happens when the psyche is utterly clean and utterly pure. You may ask, what is the meaning of the utterly pure and clean psyche? The meaning is very simple and, of course, supremely difficult to realize. The meaning is just this. Whatsoever comes to one in terms of an impulse or or an event, a circumstance, or whatever it is, or whatever arises from within us through memory and our physical condition, our condition of our health and so forth, we will never react in terms which have any relationship to greed, fear, violence, hate, stupidity, delusion, and illusion. It's as simple as that. There are the words, if you like. But now, the living life of it, which makes the difference between myself as I am, a subhuman, and myself in my full potentiality as a divine being, that's where that comes in. Now, if we understand that, then we will see one of the supreme reasons for living the religious life. There are other reasons also which one could mention. He who can live like this no longer lives unto himself separate. He is in harmony with the totality. And by being in harmony with the totality, he is a holy grail, a vessel for receiving all the transcendent energies of the divine itself, which manifest in so many different divine ways as such. which are typified in the names of the archangels and so forth.